As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to Allocation Disorder. I am Sam Staskull, joined as always by Paul Tenorio. This week we are brought to you by, drumroll, Warheads. I think they were called Warheads. Those sour candy things. Do you remember those, Paul? Those things were intense.
Why are you talking about them like Warheads don't exist anymore? They very much still exist.
They still exist? I'm not like a big sour candy guy, but I remember being in third grade or so, probably, and those first came out, and everyone was like, oh, can you do the super sour one? And it was like a big deal on the playground.
Yeah, my brother John's a big Warheads fan.
Are you? No, you don't seem like it. This one didn't do it for you.
I'm like, you know, chocolate type of guy.
This sponsor left a sour taste in your mouth. I apologize. Moving on. Big week in MLS. Week 4 of the season we're heading into. Champions League quarterfinals have wrapped up. It didn't go so great for MLS teams. We'll talk about that in a bit, along with some of Jim Curtin and Gabriel Heinze's beef, I guess we could call it, as well as a few kind of under-the-radar things that are sticking out. But MLS this week is pretty heavy on the rivalry matchups. You've got Red Bull against Toronto, Armas against his old team. We've got Vancouver, Montreal, a little bit of a Canadian matchup. Dallas against Houston, Orlando, NYCFC, 2015 expansion battle. The big one, Galaxy, LAFC. And then you have Miami, Atlanta, Portland, Seattle, and Kansas City, Austin. Beasler returning back home to Kansas City to take on Sporting. So quite a few big matchups, a lot of national TV games this weekend, Paul. Which game are you most looking forward to? And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about El Tráfico. So I'm going to remove that from the list because we're going to spend a lot of time outside of El Tráfico. Which one are you most looking forward to this weekend?
Yeah, I think if you take El Tráfico out, I think I probably am most excited. I don't want to fake it. I don't want to like lie about what I'm excited about. I think you always have to be excited about Portland against Seattle. I think that's always, but I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit disappointed in the Timbers for ruining my preseason prediction that they would win a treble.
By yeah, that one's up in smoke already.
So that one's gone. It's done. So I'm going to say Miami at Atlanta.
I mean, it's not done. I mean, it is done. They could still win a treble.
No, they can't. What treble are they going to win?
They can win. I mean, Open Cup still might happen, maybe.
We don't know. I'm counting that as not happening, so it's over.
Supporters' Shields and MLS Cup.
Well, my prediction was about a few.
It's going to be hard.
Wins.
Yeah.
Can't win the supporters.
They can't win a treble with 9 wins anymore. Yeah. Yeah, Portland-Seattle should be a good one. I'm a little less interested in that one just because the Timbers are coming off of a game on Wednesday night at Club America. They're going to be tired. I'm not sure if that's going to be the best game. I'm looking forward to Atlanta-Miami. And Orlando NYCFC, actually, I think. Those are two of the ones that stick out to me. But anyway, we can talk a little bit more about that later. The main matchup of the weekend is El Tráfico. LA Galaxy hosting LAFC, the crosstown rivals. It's a new regime for the Galaxy. It's kind of a weird start for LAFC. We don't know if Carlos Vela is going to play. He hasn't played since the first 20 minutes of their first game. Diego Rossi made his debut last week after coming back from injury. He definitely looked a little bit rusty in their draw at Houston. Paul, you and I are writing about both sides of this rivalry this week. You are writing a piece on LAFC. I am writing a piece on the Galaxy. Those will hopefully be out by the time you are listening to this. But it's two very contrasting clubs at this point in time. And I want to start with your piece on LAFC and kind of where they're at in their roster build and how they're transitioning or trying to transition from sort of phase one of being this high-powered expansion team into whatever's next. And we'll get in more after the fact about how that's so different from where the Galaxy are at as an organization at this point in time.
Yeah, and before any of you non-LA fans or fans of teams in flyover country say, I'm going to go ahead and skip out of this podcast.
Flyover country is an offensive term,
well,
by the way.
From flyover,
I don't appreciate it.
All are the ones tweeting me that we don't pay attention to flyover country. Where I live, by the way. I don't know if Chicago counts as that, but I live here. So
I mean, O'Hare is like the fly in and then fly out country, I think. Right.
But I think this is a cool episode because it goes into roster building and team building and culture building mechanisms and processes that apply across many, many different MLS teams. And especially if you are a fan of an expansion team or a team that's come into the league in the last, 5 or 6 years, I think this applies to your teams as well.
Or one that's existed since 96.
Right. Like right. When we get to the Galaxy talk, I think we'll go into kind of the rebuilding side of MLS, which is a totally different conversation. And that's why Sam and I wrote these two stories, because we think it very much is about process and roster building and kind of what goes into that and what can go right and what can go wrong. So that's where we're headed with this conversation. And with LAFC, what's interesting is really what is happening in LA is kind of a byproduct, one, of simply being an expansion team, and two, of success. And usually when you are in a capped league and you have success, you run into problems with the cap because it means that many players are performing well and thus need new contracts and raises, and you can't give everyone a raise, right? You hit a point where you start to have to look at the valuation of players and say, okay, we're not going to be able to give this player the raise that they want, or we don't think that raise fits well into the structure of the rest of our team. And so, like, Walker Zimmerman would be a good example of that for LAFC, right? He wanted a big raise. Sure. You look at it, you can get $1 million of allocation money in a trade, and you say, for what our team is doing, this is a move we have to make in anticipation of giving many other raises across the rest of the team, right? Latif Blessing.
You have cap casualties, right. Basically.
Latif Blessing got a contract. Mark Anthony Kay got a new contract. Tristan Blackman got a new contract. This is a part of the expansion build. And when I spoke to John Thorington yesterday about kind of where LAFC is in that build, what you have to remember is
John Thorington, for those who don't know, is their GM and now, I believe, co-president is the title officially.
Yeah. And what happens is usually when you kind of reach a status quo as a team, you've been existing for 4 or 5 years, kind of where LAFC is now, you start to have more players who are coming and going. And so contracts are on a staggered timeline. And that allows you, 3 to 5 additions per year and 3 to 5 departures per year. And you kind of add and subtract and try to maintain that equilibrium. But when you come in as an expansion team, you're doing a lot of contracts at the same time. And so, especially when we're talking about the really important core players of the team, a lot of times those contracts are coming up at the same time or near the same time, and require a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a reset button, but they create these windows where you want to build towards an MLS Cup, and then you know in the back of your mind, okay, we're going to have to make some adjustments. And that doesn't mean you're not trying to win MLS Cup the next year, but it means the characters are probably going to look different. And that's where LAFC is right now. They have some contracts that are coming up at the same time. Carlos Vela, Diego Rossi, Edward Atuesta, all players who were there for the inaugural season. And then they have the interest.
Atuesta is up this year.
Correct.
And Vela's next year, right?
John Thorington wouldn't comment specifically, but there are reports that Vela could be up this year. They might have an option. I think they're reaching a point with Vela where it does them a better service probably to renegotiate that deal with some guarantees rather than pick up.
Yeah,
pick
you
up
don't necessarily want to go into the final year.
Final year of the contract, right? So when you look at LAFC, what's happening now is they're looking at the summer window where they could potentially lose multiple players via sales. And, you know, they might also have to make some decisions on guys if they continue to play well and challenge for MLS Cup, who even a guy like Mark Anthony Kay or Latif Blessing, who have already had their deals redone once, you know, might start to get into that Walker Zimmerman territory where, you know, they can get more value somewhere else than they can in re-upping them again. And so, you know, I think they're approaching a point where there could be more turnover than they're accustomed to. And that's a good thing in a way, but it's also one of the unique challenges of managing the roster of an expansion team in the first 5 or 6 years of existence. And before I pass it over to you, Sam, I want to say, like, what's crazy is, like, you have a successful team in LAFC and a really successful expansion franchise in Seattle. By the time Seattle got to its fourth season of existence, it had 6 players who were on the roster in the expansion season that stayed on the roster by the fourth season. For LAFC, it's 7. So that just shows you the amount of turnover that happens when you build a roster from scratch.
I would have guessed more. Yeah,
me too. When I went into it, I kind of expected it to be way bigger. But, you know, part of that is just kind of some older veterans kind of turned over. They made a couple trades. The back half of the roster, the reserve guys kind of filtered in and out. They had, you know,
sure.
But that 6 and that 7 kind of are core players, both when you look at Seattle, what was there, guys like Ozzy Alonso and Brad Evans were a part of that group. And here with LAFC, Atuesta, Rossi, Vela, you know, all a part of that group as well.
Mark
Anthony Kay, Blessing, all guys that are part of it. So, you know, it's an interesting part of the build for LAFC right now.
Lyle agrees with you. He's super into LAFC. So if, I have a few things for you here. When I think of LAFC and their whole model, their whole design, they've been upfront and public about this, is that they were going to sell some of these guys down the road. They're now 3+ seasons in. They haven't done it yet, right? The clock's sort of ticking for some of them. They're like Rossi and Atuesta are kind of getting up there in terms of being players that are going to move for big fees and their age. So that's going to be interesting. And I think the tension with LAFC is they haven't won yet. They won the Shield. They had the best regular season ever in 2019, but they haven't won MLS Cup. They haven't won. They came close to Champions League in December. They didn't win, agonizingly short. They haven't won a knockout competition yet. They haven't won a big one. And so there's this tension of, okay, yeah, a part of our model is to sell, but we need to win too. And ownership is motivated to win. And so how do you strike that balance? And I think Atlanta is a good example here, right? Of a team that nailed it, like absolutely nailed it, where, all right, year one went well. They weren't quite ready yet. Year two, they came out like gangbusters. They were incredible all season, won MLS Cup. At the time, maybe the best single season in MLS history. 2017 Toronto would quibble with that for sure, but right up there. And then they sold Almiron right after. And they were able to kind of, you know, have the model and have it work. And LAFC, they've sort of been delayed because of the lack of playoff success.
Yeah, but I think what's most interesting about this story is we talk a lot about that conundrum of trying to balance winning now with building for the future, right? Like, that's what it's all about. And every MLS team does that, right? You try to make that balance of the present, and you have to plan for the future if you're a general manager.
Right, right, but that's the real tension with selling players mid-season, and especially.
And what,
you know?
It's been amplified, to your point, Sam. Part of the reason it's been amplified is because of COVID. The plan, realistically, the plan for LAFC was that last year was kind of the crescendo of this group of players, right? The intention was play through last year. It's going to be, you know, Rossi's like big season, and then he was going to be sold, and, you know, all the things that we're still talking about, and COVID hits. And so the transfer market essentially disappears, right? The buyers that were there are pretty much gone for a lot of the kind of mid, even to low high range, like Rossi was, $20 million price range. You know, that market was not existent. And so now they're sitting in this interesting place where they've had to stretch out that window to get to that proof of concept territory, right? Of being able to develop and sell. And at the same time, they haven't won MLS Cup because last year was like a bizarre, you know, bizarro season. And, you know, I thought Thorington brought up an interesting point where he was like, look,
I mean, they haven't won for many reasons. They weren't very good last year. Vela missed basically the whole season, but they weren't
great last year. He brought up an interesting point about, you know, if I had had a crystal ball and I was building my roster, having a bunch of young guys from foreign countries who would come to the training facility, train and go home and not be able to leave their apartment and had no one to lean on and the struggles that that created, you know, maybe I would have built it differently with domestic based players who had their wives and their kids and a little bit more balance in their lives. And, you know, he felt like those dynamics really played into last year. But I still think, interestingly, like there is, it's basically extended that tension now and amplified it a little bit of, do we sell in the summer, right? Do we sell Rossi and Atuesta and Brian Rodriguez and maybe a guy like Palacios or two of them or three of them? And they have all these contingency plans of, okay, if we sell one, here's the guy we'd replace him with. If we sell two, this is what we do. And yet you know, he says you're dealing with this idea of we want to win an MLS Cup trophy that's in December and we're facing these decisions in July, you know? And that's the problem. And I think it just makes for a really uniquely kind of soccer problem and uniquely MLS, because they are balancing right now the normal pressures of being a successful team in a capped league, which forces turnover in itself, with the pressures of an international global market when you play in a non-international calendar. So you're potentially losing players in the transfer market in the middle of your season, and it's kind of converging together. And so, you know, I hope to examine a little bit of, like, you know, how do you approach this window, and how do you, you know, they also, there's a benefit here, you know, it's a musical chairs, right? So the teams that want to buy LAFC's players have to sell their players first to fund it. So they need the teams above them to buy. And then LAFC's players would potentially be sold. And then they'll take that money and go into markets that are, you know, they could be selling to Europe where the market is starting to bounce back a little bit, and then going to buy in South America where the market's still depressed a little bit. And so there is a little bit of excitement of maybe finding the right players and finding right players for good prices, like Toronto FC just did. So some really interesting dynamics going on with LAFC, in that it's like really high expectations to win, but also some serious expectations about selling and proving the model.
For sure. And for anyone wondering, well, why don't they just wait until the winter to sell? Why not just wait until after the season? The summer is a much easier time to sell. More teams are in the market. It's the off season in Europe, so there's more player turnover. More money is being spent. And for individual players who are leaving MLS and going to Europe, it's far preferable to go in the summer when you have a full preseason and you can integrate with the squad properly, and you don't have to arrive in the middle of the year when you're not fit and you're dropped into a new team mid-season and you might not get along that great, right? And you're sort of wasting 6 months plus of your career, and that's precious time. So that's why these summer moves tend to happen. It's going to be fascinating. You know, I wrote about this, I guess it was probably summer of 2019 now, after Carlos Grueso was sold by Dallas. And Dallas is in a different spot in the hierarchy of MLS than LAFC, right? They're a good team. They're challenging for the playoffs. Of course, they want to win, but they're not like a top contender for MLS Cup. They feel comfortable moving players in the summer. First of all, Grueso isn't Diego Rossi or Eduard Atuesta in terms of his level of impact. It's a bit easier to replace, but because their academy is a lot more mature, right? And you saw that again last year with Reggie Cannon. Right? Where you can sell Reggie Cannon down the stretch in MLS and not worry about it at all because, oh, there's Brian Reynolds right behind him and he's going to perform so well and so interestingly that we're going to sell him 4 months from now for six times what we sold Cannon for. So having a mature academy can really help in this process. LAFC, they're 4 years old. They're obviously not there yet. I will be curious to see where that goes longer term. But, you know, even if they had an FC Dallas level academy, you're not replacing a Diego Rossi or an Eduard Atuesta with a homegrown player. It's a different level.
But I would say, like, again, you look at the roster moves that LAFC has made, you know, they had a couple years ago one of the youngest teams in the entire league. You know, we talk about LAFC because they operate at these higher price points, at the Carlos Vela level and Diego Rossi level of purchases. And what we don't see is like a lot of their signings are younger players, albeit many of them from abroad, but they've added some players like Bryce Duke and some of their own homegrowns who have come in. And they're
sure,
they're,
you know, and this is a strategy that arguably hurts them come playoff time.
Sure. And they, but the idea is, right, like you sign some younger players, and when you sell Atuesta, you hope that you've developed those younger players to step right into the starting lineup, right? And that's the idea. And now I think, you know, part of the discussion yesterday with Thorington was about how young money has changed this, right? And you know, from my perspective, when you look at some of the signings that LAFC has made, it feels like young money has opened up some targeted allocation money, because that's where they were buying guys like Palacios. They were using that TAM on that level of player.
Yeah, Cifuentes, Cinella
were both TAM players who now are young money players, right? And so now that TAM that was being used.
So they're young money players now.
He didn't confirm that they're officially young money, but those types of signings, and I would imagine that yes, he grandfathered those players in, are now and will be in the future young money signings, right? And so that TAM that you had allocated to signing those younger players can now be allocated elsewhere. And maybe you go a little bit more veteran. Maybe you add some, you know, some guys who are, you're not going to be able to add an in your prime star, but you can add some players who are
a typical TAM player.
Typical TAM player, and add a little bit more balance to your team where you have some of those veteran pieces for late in the season.
Interesting.
So there are all sorts of kind of intricacies to this roster build that's happening, you know, as always, at a time when the league rules are changing and modifying, and you're kind of altering your build to keep up with it, you know?
It's a living document. They're not rules, Paul. They're guidelines.
That's right. And they can be changed or altered at any time at the discretion of the league.
Absolutely. That's an interesting dynamic that you bring up about young money and TAM. I'm not sure how many teams that will apply to, because LAFC was one of the few that was spending TAM money on these young money eligible age-wise, salary-wise players. Most of that TAM was going to more veteran guys, so I'm not sure that would apply to many folks besides LAFC, but it opens up some new worlds for them in an interesting way. Anything else you want to hit on LAFC before we take a quick breather and transition to the other side of town?
No, I just think that... And you, Sam, you made this point earlier, the most interesting part of, no matter what happens in the summer, no matter who is sold and who is not, and who is purchased and who is not, like LAFC lives in a world now where it's MLS Cup or bust. And they very much recognize that. They understand that.
And that's been the case
for three years now, right? Going back to their second season. And John Thorington didn't shy away from that. He said, I understand that. The coaches understand that. The players understand that. And we want that. And he said, by the way, even if we sell players and you look at this as like kind of the second part of our build, that doesn't mean that our goal is an MLS Cup the next year too. And that's just who we want to be as a club.
No, there's real pressure on them to win, and they need to get it done. We talk about this cool project that they have going on. They've done so many things right, but they haven't cleared that ultimate hurdle yet. And until they do, that's going to be the storyline around LAFC. We'll take a quick break. Right afterward, we'll talk about a club that has cleared that hurdle 5 times, more than anyone else in MLS history, but is quite far away, I think, from that point at this very time. Of course, I'm mentioning the LA Galaxy. We'll talk about them after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Welcome back. As promised, we'll just jump right into it. We're going to talk about the other side of the El Tráfico rivalry. We talked about LAFC and their roster build and all of that stuff. LA Galaxy are in a much, much different place. This was a club first two decades of MLS, and particularly for the first half of the 2010s, they were the flagship of MLS. They were the most successful club. From 2010 to 2014, Bruce Arena, Landon Donovan, Robbie Keane, David Beckham for the first part of that, won three MLS Cups, two supporter shields. They lost another one in 2009 in a shootout. It's probably the most successful dynasty in league history. They're the glamour team. They're the one that carries the flag nationally and internationally for MLS in terms of brand awareness. And for the last 4 years, they've been terrible. I think it's fair to say. Bruce Arena, Donovan Keane, they all left following the 2016 season, and the Galaxy lost their way. And now they have Greg Vanney, who was an original player for the club. He was a big part of kind of establishing that identity in the first place. He never won an MLS Cup with LA, actually. He lost three finals, but he won a couple supporter shields, an Open Cup, and a CONCACAF Champions Cup, which was kind of the precursor to the current CCL. And he's been tasked with sort of righting this ship. And so, you know, a lot of that is roster stuff, for sure. I think they've added 13 new players, I want to say, over the offseason and into the young part of this season. So a lot of that is changeover. But the main thing with the Galaxy is resetting the culture. And it's just such a different place than LAFC. And as I've been reporting this story that should be out hopefully pretty soon, that was the main takeaway from me. It was kind of incredible to hear Greg Vanney and President Chris Klein and GM Dennis DeClos talk about these things. And Vanney basically say, yeah, there's a lot of similarities to when I took over Toronto in 2014. When he took over Toronto in 2014, that club was ambitious and they spent a lot of money and they had good fan support, but they were a disaster on the field. They had never made the playoffs. They joined the league in 2007. They had never made the playoffs. They were a joke. And Vanney was able to turn them around, right?
Yeah, Toronto was basically like Orlando City last year, right? Like they had never made the playoffs. They were they were worse than Orlando City. They were all perpetually at the bottom of the table.
It's what Cincinnati's trending to be, right? Basically,
right?
You know,
it's pretty shocking, in other words, to hear him compare the LA Galaxy to that.
But that's what he inherited, right? And he's talking about a club that doesn't have a clear vision. Right? That isn't well enough aligned between departments. And, you know, the team doesn't have an identifiable style. They don't have anything going for them in that way. And I talked to Chris Klein about this, and he basically agreed with everything. And that's kind of amazing to me for a lot of different reasons, because I'm like, well, doesn't the buck stop with Klein here on this? But Vanney is coming in, and his main thing is kind of changing that around. And Paul, I'm kind of curious what you make. The strategy makes sense, right? But what you make of the fact that it's the head coach that is the one seemingly kind of leading the charge in these directions?
Well, first of all, I want to say I think one of the most interesting parts of reporting this story for you, Sam, is you went and looked back at some things that had been written before. I wrote this same story when, you know, 2 or 3 years ago when Dennis DeClosa was first getting hired. You wrote the same story when Dennis DeClosa was getting hired. And before that, when Ziggy Schmidt was brought in, you know, these aren't issues that weren't known and diagnosed. They just never got fixed. And
to be fair, they have done some work behind the scenes since DeClosa arrived in kind of, you know, connecting the dots between the academy and the USL team and the first team in a way that's beginning to pay off in MLS, as we've seen this season so far.
And Dennis DeClosa talked about it then, that they had some contracts that they had to wait out that were guaranteed, that there was going to be a year where there was more roster turnover. And I think they still have a couple more contracts that they, you know, that will.
But every team has that. And not many teams spend as much as the Galaxy.
I'm saying from a sporting director perspective, some of the issues of the last couple rosters were not necessarily players brought in by DeClosa that you still, again, you're building a little bit at a time. And like you said, there was a lot of attention paid to the academy, to the USL, that pipeline, making it real, right? Like they tried it with Anolfo and they they hit the eject button.
Well, that's the thing.
After a half a season.
That's the thing. There's been no commitment. I think Chris Klein called it belief. There's been no belief in a vision. And so Bruce Arena left. And for so long, Bruce Arena was the identity of the Galaxy. And he was going to build a veteran team with some big stars. And his MLS vet guys like Mike McGee and Alan Gordon and AJ De La Garza and what have you. And they were going to be good. And he left in that it sort of revealed that there wasn't a foundation, right? It was him and that roster. And they left and it became a house of cards and it all crumbled. And so they went to this youth movement, right? They promoted Kurt Anolfo. He had been their coach for USL. They promoted Pete Vahanis. He had been the VP of soccer ops to GM. And they emphasized the USL roster and academy and promoting players from within. And they tried it for 20 games. 20 games. And then they pulled the plug and they brought in Ziggy Schmid. And he was worse than Anolfo was down the stretch in 2017, actually. And then he goes into the offseason. He's given GM powers. And he builds kind of a more veteran, more sensible, kind of Bruce Arena-style team, right? Similar to what he had in Seattle all those years. Ola Kamara was acquired. He had scored a ton of goals for Columbus. And you had Kamara, and he was meant to be the focal point. And you had Gio Dos Santos and Jonah Dos Santos and Roman Alessandrini and Sebastian Legette. And things are looking okay. And then a couple weeks into the season, boom, Zlatan, right? And it didn't necessarily fit the plan, but you're not going to say no to Zlatan. You make it work. And Chris Klein said it to me. They weren't ready for it. They didn't construct it properly around Zlatan ever. And he scored, I think, 52 goals in two seasons, and they missed the playoffs one year, and they finished like fifth the next. They were a one-man team. They didn't ever improve the back line, which is still kind of a mess. And again, no vision, no identity. It's not a team. It hasn't been a team, Paul. It's just been like kind of this weird amalgamation of like, hey, we're the Galaxy. We're going to sign some big stars and we'll be fine. And MLS has changed. That's not good enough anymore.
Yeah, I think part of it, though, Sam, and we've mentioned so many different names here, so many different decision makers, all of them making decisions. And it never felt like it was like one vision, right? Like they were getting in a room and making a decision together, you know, like,
yeah,
like we hear about with Seattle all the time, right? Like it was like Ziggy put this roster together, you know, Zlatan is signed by not Ziggy, you know, like those types of things were happening a lot, or like the decision to go to Anolfo and run it this way. And 20 games later, somebody else made a decision. That's not the way the Galaxy is going to operate. And right. So I'm going to go back to the question I didn't answer that you asked me before about like Greg Vanney doing this and is this the job of the coach? Obviously, it's not the job of the coach, but I do think that I have been.
It's not the job of the coach either. Right. It's a collective job.
But like part of it to me is like I have been a big advocate of this, and I think this is a really good example of why it's the right move for the Galaxy. When you look around the league, there have been certain teams that have enjoyed a consistent level of success and have created a culture within the club and a way of not just a culture, but a way of operating within a club. And the two best examples of that I wrote about last year and jinxed them both in a way, Seattle and Toronto. And so to go and get somebody who was a big decision maker in Toronto and basically say,
I mean, he's a huge part of setting that.
Right.
He's like most important person in setting that,
sure,
really.
Sure. And so you take that and you say, we're essentially purchasing that knowledge, right? Like we are purchasing.
Lyle's having a big show, man.
Lyle he's the really Zlatan of this show. This he's a big,
he's
LA
the Zlatan of this show.
He's an LA dog, basically. Yeah, I just think that like they purchased that knowledge, right? They purchased that expertise. And so I think it's a good thing that Greg Vanney is trying to set that tone and create that culture and be a driver of that in LA, because that's what they're paying for. They're paying for that experience from Toronto.
Yeah, 100%. It's just kind of funny to me that it's like this isn't really like this should be the GM and the president that have been there. Klein's been president, I think, since 2013. Tecosa's been there 2.5 years, you know? I didn't even get to Baros Skoloto, who they brought in and it was a mess last season. Like, the vibes on that team were terrible. Like, the body language, everything was a disaster. And you can see the difference already in that way under Vanney. just 3 weeks into the season. And that's been really positive. So I think it was a slam dunk hire. We've talked about this before, but it's just kind of weird to me that it's like, why couldn't you figure this out earlier? And then a couple of other interesting notes from this story. There were a few inflection points here where things could have gone so differently. 2017, Anolfo is struggling, right? And they're thinking about making a change. Then when they talk to Bob Bradley, and he ends up going to LAFC, and this all happened on the same day, all of these announcements. So LA announces that Anolfo is out and Ziggy is in, and LAFC announces like 3 hours later that Bradley is the coach, and the Galaxy at some point, maybe after the Bradley announcement, announced Jonah Dos Santos that same day. So that was kind of a wild day in LA soccer. And then a couple years later, after Ziggy's gone, they went after Caleb Porter, right? There's Klein and Porter, who I believe were college teammates at Indiana. They're courtside at a Lakers game, and it looks like that deal's going to get done. And then Porter ends up going to Columbus, and they hire Baro Scalotto. Can you imagine how different things would have been for the Galaxy in recent years had they hired Bob or had they hired Caleb instead of Ziggy and Baro Scalotto, right? Who knows what it would have looked like? Would Bob have even signed off on Zlatan, right? Would he have had the power to veto Zlatan if he wanted to? Right? It's just kind of fascinating to go back and play the what if game with the Galaxy. I am very, very interested to see what this club is going forward, because as this is something Vanny hammered home with me, he doesn't see this as like a full teardown. The ceiling in LA is fantastic, right? And it's not like they have bad players. Like, they have some good players on this team, right? So it's going in and it's just being, the word he used a million times was clarity, right? Clarity and style of play. Clarity within that style of play in terms of the individual elements, clarity in communication, clarity between the sports science and the medical department and the ticket sales staff and the first team and USL and the academy and MLS and all of these things, just kind of creating a culture in that way. And it's a hollow term, but it's going to be curious to see if he can pull it off. He did in Toronto. It's a big job that he has on his hands in LA.
Sam, are there lessons that you think you heard in this reporting this this story that apply to other teams that have maybe struggled the last couple of years in
yeah.
MLS.
I mean, dude, this is universal. And like, it sounds corny. Like this, like Toklosa said it to me. He's like, culture and identity, these are hollow terms, right? They're buzzwords. They don't mean anything unless you actually go every single day and assign them meaning and basically live up to the standards that you're preaching. And I think back to when I was in Salt Lake and Jason Kreis was head coach and team is the star. That was the motto, right? It was painted on the walls. It was, you know, it was corny. It was, we kind of would say it as a joke sometimes around the office, but it bled through. And I'm not talking about bleeding through to the players or the trainers or the kit man or anyone on the team side. It bled through in the sponsorship department and ticket sales and PR, everywhere it bled through. And that sort of created this whole identity in Salt Lake at the time, which was, we might be an underdog, we might be the smallest market, we might be on a budget, but we're going to ball. And like, we're going to be better and we're going to punch above our weight. And that seeped through. And that's what I think of when I think of culture at a club, right? And Vanny was able, I think, to build that. Obviously, it looked different in Toronto. They weren't anyone's idea of an underdog, right? And now he has to do it again in LA. And it's the daily actions, right? It's the intentions. And it's holding people accountable each and every day and staying consistent. And that's the thing the Galaxy haven't had. They haven't had the consistency, right? None of this is rocket science, but it's every single day. Can you pull it off? Can you be consistent? And he's done it before. I think he'll do it there.
Yeah, and I think there's some similarities here with what happened in Orlando with Oscar Pereja. Similar type of coach who's been successful in the league, came in, created a culture within Orlando, created a consistent playing style. The players didn't change that much. Something else did, you know, and that's Greg Vanney's job now, is to create that change, create that consistency, the consistency in the message, right? That creates an expectation. And then that expectation transfers from the training facility and the offices over to the field on the weekends. And that leads to results. And, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. And Sam, I don't want to get into it too much in this episode, but we talked about it on our staff call with the rest of the athletic staff today. I do think there is an interesting dynamic here with the value of MLS experience in leadership in your office. I think obviously Dennis DeClosa had experience at Chivas USA and Chris Klein has been around for a really long time. But when you have a head coach who came in Scalotto who didn't know the league and you didn't have a lot of direction behind the scenes, even with some of that MLS experience, or there was so much to do behind the scenes that it was overwhelming, you know, there is a lot of value to be had in a knowledge of the
league
and a respect for building based on the talent in the league and starting to fill some holes on your roster with guys that you're familiar with who you know can be successful in the league. Viafania was a signing this year for the LA Galaxy. Even Victor Vasquez, who's not thought of as an MLS player.
I think Vasquez really is the one, man.
Really important guy who Greg Vanney knew he could count on, that would know the system, know the way, knew the league, all of those things.
He can be a culture soldier for Vanney, basically.
Play similar role to what Michael Bradley was in Toronto, essentially. Kind of a conduit from the culture of the leadership into the culture of the locker room. And you know, I think a big part of that is just knowing the league, just knowing what you need and knowing who the guys are that can give you some of that culture on the field.
100%. And to close to set it in our interview, and I didn't put this in the story, but basically he was like, not only does Greg know the rules and the regulations and the obstacles, right? But he understands those in a way that you're able to find the loopholes and turn those regulations and restrictions into opportunities, right? And it makes such a big difference when you can operate at a level like that as opposed to somebody coming in blind. Makes such a big difference. Let's take one more quick break here. After the break, we're going to talk about two other coaches, Jim Curtin, Gabby Heinze. One trying to establish a culture in Atlanta, another one with maybe one of the best in the league in Philly, and them kind of, you know, they're beefing. They're beefing, Paul. So we'll talk about that and run down some other things happening around MLS and CCL after the break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Welcome back. Thank you for sticking with us. Two break episode. Big, big show. That's huge for us. We were professional about it, despite the dog barking repeatedly. I mentioned the beef between Curtin and Heinze. So CCL went poorly for MLS. Only one of the five teams that made it to the quarterfinals advanced. Yeah, I know. Shocking, right? Only one of the five teams made it to the quarterfinal advanced. That one team happened to be playing another MLS team. So it was guaranteed that one would make it through. That team was Philly against Atlanta. They held on. They won 1-0, I think. Or was it 1-1? I can't even remember. It was 1-1. But it was 4-1 on aggregate. Union advanced, made it pretty easy on themselves after that first leg. And Curtin and Heinze were kind of going back and forth a little bit during the game. And our colleague Felipe Cardenas asked Jim Curtin about the little exchange that they had during the match. And Curtin had a long, interesting comment. And I'll just read it. In part right now. So he said of Heinze, he's an incredible coach, an incredible player, but you can still be a sore loser and be an asshole at the end of the game. So I still think there's a right way. I think he should shake hands like a man after the game. They'll probably have to say something to say now that I've said that, but I'm not just going to sit here and take it anymore. He continued on. I think there's great American coaches in this league. There's great foreign coaches in this league. And I don't want to make anything more of it than that. But, you know, it's maybe something that he switches the subject. But that line right there, I think there's great American coaches in this league. There's great foreign coaches in this league. I don't want to make, and then he sort of stops himself, right? It was what we were just talking about. And Paul, that dynamic is super interesting to me because there is this complex among, it's not even Americans or Canadians. It's among MLS people versus non-MLS people who are in MLS. And Curtin sort of got at it there. I'm curious what you made of those comments.
Well, what's interesting is for a long time, this league was incredibly insular, right? The same people had the same jobs. I used to joke about it. I used to joke that when we went to the scouting combine, you had to look at their polo shirts to see which assistant coaches were with what clubs at that point, you know, because the same guys were kind of moving from team to team. And
it's still sort of true.
And it's still sort of true, but it certainly has been made more international on the coaching level and on the sporting director level. And what's more interesting about that is despite it becoming more international, there's really been one coach who came into the league. Well, I would say two coaches who came into the league with no MLS experience and had success. The first and the biggest is Tata Martino, who won an MLS Cup in Atlanta. And the second, in my opinion, is Patrick Vieira, who I think built a very successful team at NYCFC. Sporting director wise, I can think of one sporting director who came into this league from outside of MLS and had success. And that is Ernst Tanner in Philadelphia, who I think has done a phenomenal job since coming into MLS. Maybe I'm forgetting someone, Sam. If I am, please point it out. But
you probably are, but I can't remember either.
That
so.
Matters because despite that record of not having success, more and more MLS owners are being advised to go international for these hirings. So you look at FC Cincinnati, which went international. Charlotte has gone international. St. Louis has gone international. And
Chicago
went international. And this is coming clearly from the league office, from these consulting firms that are being recommended to these owners to hire these people and have them recommend hires. And so these domestic coaches and domestic GMs who have been successful are saying, wait a second, why are we so undervalued despite the fact that we're winning MLS Cups and winning supporter shields? And maybe some of these coaches deserve a level of respect. And I think that's what Jim Curtin was trying to say. He recognizes what Heinze had done in his native Argentina, but he doesn't need to
incredible playing career, right?
And he had done well in his managerial career, right? He was building a good managerial career, but he's like, I'm not going to get down on one knee to that. Like I won the supporters shield last year. And that is what's, that is where this undercurrent is coming from, because we're just seeing it happen over and over. Like, I will put money down right now. You, first of all, you cannot name a team in MLS that has had a foreign coach and a foreign GM and been successful. Like, they had both in the office. So, right. But I will put money down right now that Charlotte hires a foreign coach to go along with an international GM, despite that knowledge. And like,
yeah, a non MLS is just to clarify. Non-MLS. He's like Oscar Pereja. Sure. He's Colombian, exactly. But he's an MLS hire, right?
Right, right. Yeah. For sure. And so that to me is like, that's what we're talking about here. Is like that's a level of arrogance, right? To make the same mistake over and 100%. Over and over again. To look at all
no
of the history.
No one learns, man. It drives me insane.
Crazy.
No one learns.
Like, I was like frustrated the other day. I was talking about the Chicago Fire. Like, they've made zero MLS signings. Zero in 2 years.
It's amazing.
That's crazy.
Excluding homegrowns.
Excluding homegrowns who don't see the field. You know,
right.
One saw the field last year, Pineda. I shouldn't say zero, because Pineda certainly played.
Yes.
But, you know, that's nuts. And so, like, that there's a level of arrogance that we know better than you, despite the fact that history shows when it comes to MLS, you decidedly do not. You decidedly do not.
And it's a level of ignorance, too, from ownership. In terms of which candidates they should be hiring and which people they should be targeting and which people within the league might be good at these jobs that aren't in them just yet. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating. But it is interesting. Paul, I know you have to go soon. You have to run to a press conference and do your journalism job. But before we go, let's just run down really, really fast some players, some teams, some coaches, whatever. Folks through the first 3 weeks of the season that are impressing you and maybe flying a little bit under the radar. Let's hand out some flowers. Let's give some people some love.
Yeah, I'll give some love to a player that I'm writing about right now, and that's Tyler Pascher of the Houston Dynamo. What I like about Tyler Pascher is that he represents this part of U.S. soccer that, you know, I'm sure Jeff Reuter will be glad to hear me talk about this, because I've taken an antagonistic point sometimes talking about the lower divisions of U.S. soccer. But Tyler Pascher, you know, when he was starting his professional career, got moved from an attacking player to a left back, tried to make it to MLS as a left back, got signed by Kansas City, you know, had a brief run there, went back to the USL and got moved back into an attacking role in Indy, and was signed by Houston and has had a really bright start to his career in Houston. I just finished talking to Tab Ramos about him. He was just saying, you know, I thought it would take him a little longer to get used to the speed of play. And he came in and wasn't afraid of anything and kind of embraced the challenge and adapted much quicker than anyone was anticipating and gives so much of himself, you know, even when he's having a struggle on the ball. So Tyler Pascher is a player who's kind of stood out to me as just a really cool story. And to see him playing the way he's played early on has been a nice one for a team, by the way, who I think has improved a ton from year over year in Houston.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if they can keep it up. I have 4 points through three games, but, you know, I think they've been better than expected for sure.
Joe Corona, a really big part of that, an MLS experienced player that Tab Ramos went out and identified to help change things in the culture and the kind of approach in that locker room, by the way.
I'm just gonna run down a few here really fast, just rattle them off. Diego Fagundes in Austin has been interesting. New lease on life after a long time in New England for him. Leon Flock in Philly. I like that one.
Really
under
good
the
player.
Radar pickup.
Really good player.
This is not under the radar, but Christian Roldan has been awesome this year. Awesome for Seattle, especially with Ladero out. I'm curious to see what it looks like when Ladero is now coming back in to the 11. Rubio Rubin, what a cool story. With RSL, they're 2-0. No one expected that. And Rubin has 2 goals and 2 assists in 2 matches. He was such a hot prospect, had some injuries, and then fell off for a long time. But he tore it up in USL in a brief stint in San Diego last year, and RSL was really high on him all preseason. He's showing why right now. Olivier Mbiazo in Philly. I think that's one that people should keep an eye on at right back. I think Kyle Duncan had some struggles in week one, but I like what he's brought for the Red Bulls the last couple of games. Zach Brogiard up in Montreal, left back, he's done some good things. And I'm going to throw a weird one at you, Paul. I like what Miami's looked like. Not necessarily the most aesthetically pleasing, but you talk about culture, right? To loop that back around, they're fighting. They're working hard for each other. They look like a proper team. Gregory has been good for them. I think he's contributed a lot in that way. And so I like the foundation that's being set there by Phil Neville. So those are the ones for me.
I want to throw one more in there. It's a player that, you know, I think a lot of people would normally overlook, that someone like Sam might not truly appreciate, but that, you know, really has caught my eye with his strong play early. And that's Nuhu at left center back. I think he's been...
No, I was going to do it. Ah, you beat me. He's been awesome, man. I'm so happy about it. Oh, he's been fantastic.
Yeah, I'm surprised he wasn't on your list. I felt like I needed to point that out and make sure everyone realized
that. I mean, he was. I was just going to do this grand finale thing. I had it all planned out, and then you came and you ruined it. You ruined it.
That's what I like to do. After one person commented on Twitter that last week's episode was the saddest episode ever of Allocation Disorder, to come back around with one more punch to Sam is a real positive way to wrap this one up.
Well, thanks, folks, for listening. This has been hopefully not the saddest episode, maybe just the second saddest. But thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. This has been Allocation Disorder.